I'm John Barry. I'm the director at the Office of Personnel Management here for the federal government. And so I tell people I'm the people person for the government and having a ball. Now, some of the basics, if you go out this door, there is a men's room straight across from us here, and there is a woman's room down the hall to the right. Okay, so it's sort of at the end of this corner. You are in what is these are historically the Secretary of War's offices.
Oh, interesting.
And before this became the old executive office building, in World War II, before the Pentagon was built, this was the War Department. And so you will notice many of the sort of military regalia, et cetera, and it's because of that. So it's you're actually in a very historic room. The beginnings of World War II were actually, you know, many of the major decisions at the beginning were made in these rooms. So it's now part of the White House complex. And we're very honored to have you all here today. I thought what would be great would be to go around the table first and introduce ourselves. Before I do that, I just have a couple of housekeeping things. They say moderators must announce. So we're going to ask that we're going to have everybody introduce themselves real quick. But then also, when you're talking, because we're new to each other, please just remind people where you're from or your name. That would be great. We'd ask. We have microphones. We are being live streamed. And I'm not sure why, but they ask us not to have cell phones on the table. So I'm not sure exactly why, but maybe it has something to do with the mics.
Yeah.
And then people ask us not to brush the mics with our paper. And I think since we see the mics, there's no paper, we should be okay there. Let me just quickly introduce some folks who are helping us today. Our note taker is Robin Fernkiss from the Domestic Policy Council, who's helping sort of make sure we have a record of all of the great thoughts that come out today, so you don't have to worry about taking notes. We will do that for you, and we will be packaging this up and getting it out to everybody, so you'll have that. We've got a facilitator to help us, Maggie Chen, who is here from CWG, who is here to help us. And we are very honored to have the Director of Policy and Projects for the First Lady, Jocelyn Fry, who is here with us to help me sort of move things along. Why don't we run around the room real quick, and then I will focus us on a few questions that we're going to try to do. What we're going to try to do is spend the first hour on what are the best practices. What are the sort of the one, two, or three superstar ideas that you might be doing, or that you and your area, and especially we want to hear first from our corporate leaders. And then we'll turn to some of the foundations and nonprofit folks who are here with us today and other thought leaders. But we want to hear sort of what's working. What are the gold nuggets we want to catch for everybody? And what are the sort of the biggest challenges you face? So we'll all get a crack at that. We'll spend about an hour doing that and have that discussion. And then the last 30 minutes or so, we thought we would turn to thinking ahead. Now we've got the work report. We've got a lot of material that you all will be getting on this of sort of current best practices. The questions are, where does this wave go? You heard sort of, Campbell Soup saying that this is a wave. Well, if it's a tsunami, where is it taking us? And, so maybe thinking ahead, what are we not doing yet? What's not already been adopted, but that might be coming down the road? What's the sort of over the horizon thought? And so we thought we'd spend the tail end sort of maybe thinking a little bit over the horizon, because that may help the administration as we sort of try to think forward and try to actually think ahead. So just framing up sort of the discussion for us today. With that, let me turn, we'll go to the right and we'll come around. Why don't you kick off, just tell us who you are, where you're from, and we'll run around the room.
This is John Daniel. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer for First Horizon, a bank headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee.
Jim Rotman, Vice President of Global Work Life, American Express, New York City.
Ron Glover, Vice President of Diversity and Workforce Programs for IBM.
Barbara Adachi, I head up the Women's Initiative and National Managing Partner for Deloitte.
Jody Calamine, I'm General Counsel at the Education and Labor Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives.
And I'm Kevin Campbell with Accenture, and I'm the Group Chief Executive for Technology.
Nilafar Malavi, I'm the Chief Diversity Officer for PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Tia Mitchell-Gordon, I'm Chief Diversity Officer for AOL. I'm Karen White. I direct the Working Families Programs at the Center for Women at Work at Rutgers University.
I'm Sheila Willing, and I teach at Stern and NYU Business School. Women in Business Leadership is my field.
Hi, I'm Danette Campbell. I'm the Senior Advisor for Telework at the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
I'm Bruce Pfau. I'm Vice Chairman of Human Resources for KPMG.
I'm Karen Elsey. I'm Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Institute for a Competitive Workforce.
I'm Katie Corgan. I'm co-director of a policy initiative at Georgetown Law School called Workplace Flexibility 2010.
I'm Kathleen Christensen. I'm with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation in New York. And through the program I direct, we fund research on working parents, older workers, and also had a national initiative on workplace flexibility.
I'm Debbie Martin, CEO of Business and Professional Women's Foundation, and we're working on our successful workplaces movement where we're bringing employees and employers together to discuss issues and find solutions for things like workplace flexibility.
Great.
We're David Smith, the DESCO Office of Diversity, responsible for flexibility and men's rights.
And I'm Jennifer Mason from the Office of Personnel Management.
Joe, welcome.
Thank you. Joe Davis in Washington Post.
Joe from Washington Post, and we got everybody, and then our video crew, so we'll get to work. A couple things that you might not be aware of. First is we did try to group you all by sort of like having a conversation with like. So there are actually two corporate panels. We put another group that is more of a service retail focus that faces different challenges, and then more of the white-collar, larger-style organizations that could be together in this group. So just so we, from the corporate side, you at least we'd be kind of have a like community. We tried to do that to the best extent possible. Let me just hit on two sentences, and then we're going to jump right in, and I am going to take the chair prerogative by first asking Ron, I gave him a little heads up to this, to jump off the cliff first. But just to say here, I do want to just focus again. This session is an attempt to focus on the best practices of all of our companies in the room, the specific experiences that we've experienced in the corporate setting. It will also help us grapple with the day-to-day techniques and approaches that managers use to ensure the best possible results from workplace flexibility policies. We're going to have to work on all of the alliteration in that. There's a lot going on in there. But to kick us off and to get us started, we've asked Ron to jump in here and sort of give us, you know, best successes, best, you know, biggest challenges, so that you can kind of get us going, and then we'll let the rest of the corporate partners jump in as you best think. We won't do it in any order, but then we'll throw it open. So, Ron, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. We have been doing a series of surveys with our workforce dating back to 1986, asking questions, really trying to get them to describe for us what they need to be more productive and more able to integrate their work and personal life. And what's come across most loudly and most clearly is a desire for us to give them greater flexibility and control about when and where they do their work. So for us, our best practices have been trying to build both the culture, the infrastructure, the policy, and the process in an integrated way, end to end, to enable that to happen. So it's as simple as being clear about, you know, the kinds of work, the circumstances under which people can work flexibly, maximizing the ability of the employer and the employee, manager and individuals to engage in those conversations, providing infrastructure and tools, BlackBerries, access to internet, and all the systems that make it possible for people to work when and where it makes the most sense for them. We've got the benefit, by virtue of having done that, of actually now having a pretty flexible workforce where about 44% of our people don't come into an IBM office any day. They're working at home, they're at a customer site, they're working from the road, and they're engaging each other, which is the other advantage that we've seen, flexibly, so that work is no longer a place, it's what we do and we do together, and we construct and deconstruct the teams. So the best practice then really begins to say, as opposed to thinking about this just as a kind of philosophical way of managing, embedding what you're doing around this and the way you manage the business, the way you hire people, how you train and deploy them, the training systems for managers and others, that all come together when you think about it as an end-to-end system, as a way of being inside the corporation. And the more you do that, the more it becomes embedded in the operations of the company, and more critically, in the culture of the company. So that the kind of conversations we hear where it's unnatural for an employee to ask for flexibility, or a manager to have an adverse reaction because they're used to managing, you know, what goes from head to toe, as opposed to what the employee produces every day, the results that are produced, no longer becomes the issue of the organization. The impediments for us, and the things that we have to watch out for, really come into two broad categories. First, we need to be sure that, you know, legislative policy and practice supports our ability to give the employees that flexibility, that we aren't trying to manage them in the same way we try to manage a workforce where it was fixed in continuous schedules and fixed in continuous places. You know, legislation from the 30s and 40s where everybody went to work from 9 to 5, took a lunch break between 11:15 and 12, left at 5 o'clock, no work was done and no need for interaction exist. In our workforce, people come and go. I have a person working for me who took 2 hours off in the middle of the day yesterday and picked up the BlackBerry, you know, while she was cooking for the family and was engaged in conversations. So we don't track the number of customers. We don't track, you know, we trust that they're getting the work done, and we built a system that enables that to happen. The greater the flexibility we get in support of that, the more we can do. Second challenge is, part of what you do miss when you no longer have that kind of fixed and continuous workplace and people coming together physically is the interaction for knowledge transfer, cultural transmission, and other things. So what we're trying to do is create within our own organization alternative ways for people to come together in community, to learn from each other, to share best practices, to, you know, do culture transmission and knowledge transmission across the enterprise. Some of that is the use of technology. Some of it is just creating opportunities for people to form communities in whichever way is comfortable for them. So that's a kind of good summary.
Ron, could I ask one other question? Is, you know, one of the greatest fears I hear when we're talking about this with workers is that how are we going to put bumpers on this? Does this mean I'm going to be ended up working, you know, 20 hours a day as opposed to 8? You know, is the BlackBerry a chain that I can never break? Mm-hmm. How have you all handled that, or how do you manage that situation with your employees?
So it's managed in a couple of ways. First of all, and at the panel discussion earlier, our colleagues from Campbell's Soup talked about giving people in teams the ability to engage and have discussions about how the teams and the work groups are going to get the work done in ways that allow the coverage, but that don't burn people out in the process. And so we count on that within our organization so that, you know, if I need Wednesday off, it may mean I'm going to work longer hours on Tuesday. Or, you know, if my time frame, the thing that works best for me is 7 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, a break in the middle of the day and time off, that because we work in teams, we work together. If we can engage in conversations, we find that people can, in fact, manage this in ways that don't result in them working 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. You do, in candor, have to set the expectation, and the leaders who lead have to understand that a part of their responsibility isn't just assigning work, it's paying attention to the workload and the amount of time that you're demanding of people. And to be watching, we use instant messaging systems, for example, as a way to communicate because we're all, you know, spread all over the world. Well, one of the ways as a leader that I pay attention to whether or not my people are working is I watch to see when the light is green on their instant messaging system. And if I see them there too often and, you know, too many long hours, I have a responsibility as a manager to engage in the conversation in ways that say, okay, let's manage this. And then finally to set a culture that says, flexibility doesn't mean working all the time. It means you really do get time off in this process. And if you're not asking for it, I've got to reach out to you and really try to make sure it's occurring.
Don't you agree, though, Ron, that a lot of it has to do with the conversation that you just talked about? Because we have situations, for example, where, for me, sitting down on Sunday morning and sending out a bunch of messages and answering my emails, that works for me. My people, when they receive those messages, and when I first started working with them, said, you expect me to be responding to you on Sunday? And I had to have a conversation, say, no, I don't expect you to be responding, but for me, my flexibility, it works for me to be sending these things out. So don't consider this a demand to respond on Sunday, just that this is how flexibility works for me. And I think that a lot of it depends on that sort of trust that Doug was talking about earlier, and the conversation that you want to have with people so that these new boundaries are set up.
I've encouraged my worker. Jennifer's here. She's my deputy chief of staff. They know I often will get up at 3:30 in the morning in a panic, and the BlackBerry's by the bed.
Right.
And you'll be sending out the three hair-on-fire messages. You know, but I've let the staff know, you know, your BlackBerry should be turned off at night, so I'm not disrupting your sleep with that. So, you know, I don't expect you to look at it at 3:30 in the morning, but, you know, please, at, you know, 7:30, I hope, and you'll see it.
Exactly.
You know, so you do have to have those conversations.
And the globalization also, I mean, if somebody is responding to you from India, they're going to be responding at 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's just the way it is. And you begin to adapt to that, I think, if you have an open mind and an open attitude towards operating in a flexible environment.
How do you ingrain that into practice? Because I'm again in a company where 24/7, I mean, I'm feeling kind of, I haven't looked at my BlackBerry today, so I'm kind of feeling it. How do you ingrain that, though, into the mindset of not just your employees, but oftentimes it's the managerial mindset that is the biggest barrier to making what you want to happen in theory actually happen in practice?
I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to answer it in a different way, in that at PwC, the way we define flexibility is a little different as well, and I'm sure others will be able to relate to this, is that flexibility is not about a point in time in your career that you need that flexibility. Flexibility is something that people need over their entire career, and there's going to be different levels of flexibility and types of flexibility that you're going to need. And when we design our flexible work arrangements, we have that in mind, that it's got different individuals in order to be able to meet their personal goals and their professional goals. So I think it comes back to a little bit of the communication, being able to have that discussion about all the different ranges of flexibility that exist, and what may be working for you at that point in time in your career, and making sure everybody else understands that as well. And I think we have been able to, you know, we'll talk, I guess, later about best practices, but been able to give that range and encourage that discussion and engagement in that discussion for all our people.
I heard some parents who asked for flexibility to be working at home when their kids were young, but when they became teenagers, they said they couldn't wait to get into the office. So you're exactly right, is that this changes over the course of one's life.
Yeah, at American Express, what we've done is start to define different work styles and actually allow people to identify themselves based on the kind of work style that they're in today. And so if there's something that some people want to be in the office 5 days a week, there may be reasons why they can't be more flexible outside of the office. And some people want to have complete flexibility, work 100%. So by helping them kind of identify their work style, it has a clear kind of obligation that they have to the company on how they work. There's an obligation from a leader on how to manage that. There's implications in terms of technology and office space. But by defining that, it helps them understand it, and it's clear what everybody's kind of schedules and roles are. We've actually started posting internal positions with those type of styles associated with them, so someone doesn't have to ask for flexibility. It's assigned to the role already, so someone can say, oh, this is a real flexible role, I want that role. And they don't have to go through this process of explaining why, applying for it, negotiating with their leader. It's already built into the jobs that we're designing.
I was gonna say, at Deloitte, we've kind of done something similar that we actually call mass career customization. And it's an ability to customize your career around different dimensions. And recognizing that careers and work kind of ebb and flow over time, if you can picture, I'm going to date myself here, a stereo equalizer with different levels, levers. There's actually four levers that people can dial up or down. One is pace, which is how quickly they want to move to the next level. One is workload. Can they work a full workload or are they reduced? Another one is location, because travel is such a big part of professional services. Can they travel or are they restricted? And the last one is role. Are they going to be a leader? Are they leading the project? Or are they individual contributors? So people kind of can move these knobs up and down. And kind of, and then it's very transparent. I think the other thing that I heard in the panel was, in order to have the conversation, that transparency is key. We've rolled this out to all 40,000 of our U.S. employees, and so the framework and the terminology is there to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've learned through this is that by having that out there, it's not so much that people are going to take advantage of that today, but they know that they have the option to do it in the future. Because frankly, one of our challenges, John, in this area has been the recession. We haven't had as many people feel as comfortable dialing down, our CEO says, because sometimes that could be interpreted as dialing out. Mm-hmm. And so we expect that, you know, over time to increase. But, you know, the idea is that we also measure employee satisfaction and engagement. We did see a 28% increase in people's feelings about their future ability to have a good, what we call career life fit. But that's all about, again, to your point, the conversation and the transparency, because I think by having a common language like you do, it's easier to approach that conversation without thinking you're going to be really unique.
I think you can't.
One of the things that I've observed, and your book on mass career customization, something I give my students, I mean, I know but in any event, is that what we're seeing around the table are firms. And, you know, one can almost.
There's five different groups, and you all will, all of us will share, we'll be getting a memo out, report from all of the groups. Everybody will get access to all of that. So these discussions are going on with sort of different foci or focus points in each of those five groups.
You wanted to make a point.
Go ahead.
I think just to that point, though, you know, one of the things about this conversation is trying to figure out, are there certain things that many of your companies are doing that are transferable? You know, are there principles and lessons, whether it's, you know, the communication, whether it's, you know, I think the question about how you train managers is a good one. Are there a set of things that you all sort of collectively do that could be shared with companies across the board, regardless of whether you're, you know, a banking type of a firm or accounting or technology or your manufacturing? I think it's those types of things that hopefully we can lift out that would be helpful for the companies who aren't doing the same sort of things that you're doing.
Absolutely.
Let me reserve this gentleman's right. He's been very so kind.
You know, a lot of what has been discussed resonates, because to me, the number one thing is about leadership, right? In Accenture, we've had a generational switch to this. So today, of our 30,000 U.S. workforce, 72% of our people have some kind of flexible arrangement. But that comes, the generation that ran before us didn't have that, right? But, you know, I tell people all the time, and in every example, every leadership panel I have five kids, right? So the first question is, how do you do that and do this job, right? I have 125,000 people that work for me, right? How do I manage that? First thing I tell them is there's a lot of similarities between those two things. But the key is, right, and this is what came back around when you talk about having the levers.
Yes.
Because, you know, I understand the factory workers might be a little tougher, but our business is a customer service business. paid by the clients. You know, clients generally want you there all the time. So it was traditionally viewed as one of the hardest businesses. There's travel, there's all those other things. And we just started at this from an area of retention, right? And trying to make sure that we can keep the best and the brightest people, because as a couple of people said, over your career, you change during that time.
Let me ask you, building on that, though, to get back to sort of the original premise that Ron had, what specific best practices have you found? What are the two or three at Accenture that you say that now everybody looks at them as the no-brainer? Boy, these are the ones that, why didn't we do them 10 years earlier? What are them?
They're a couple of things, really, right? So the flexible, the telecommuting is obviously something that's important. But the telecommuting is even more powerful today because it's enabled by technology, right? So we talked about AIM, or whatever kind of instant message that you want to use. But there's also a set of collaboration tools that can make people feel like they're still there. So we have telepresence installed in 50 of our locations. Now we have every employee has a video camera and is connected to Office Communicator, happens to be the product. But so they can participate, because one of the things that people we find with people that are afraid to be out of the office or, you know, not connected in the same way to everybody is they don't get to see the faces. So the use of the video camera, you know, and the technology is such now that, you know, I do half of my leadership teams are all done that way. I have people all around the world and we do them for 4 hours. Whoever's talking, the camera automatically switches to them. Right? So those tools, you can all see the presentation, you can draw on it and everybody see it. Those type of tools, for me, have been the things that have given us, beyond just acceptance and leadership demonstration, those tools and that technology has given us what's kind of a head and shoulders jump on how this works and how productive we are when we're working together.
So, let me go to Danette, and then we'll go back to the corporate world.
Yeah, very, very quickly. And speaking of that, that's a great lead-in. I'm with the Patent and Trademark Office in Alexandria, Virginia. And while we are, in fact, a federal entity, we run our business like a corporation. It's a really pretty amazing thing. But I think what's equally as amazing is I sit here listening to all of you in the private sector speaking to the commonalities, if you will, about remote working and about flexible work schedules. And those are all of the same things, in fact, that we have at the Patent and Trademark Office. We have a telework program that has actually been in place for 14 years. It started with 18 examining attorneys in the Trademarks organization, which I call the little engine that could, because Trademarks is about one-tenth of the size of the patents organization. But they started this telework initiative, and quite frankly, a woman whose name is Debbie Cohn, started this. She was doing a project. And they wanted to retain their excellent trademark attorneys who they were losing because some of them were starting families, some of them had elder care issues to deal with, so forth and so on. Again, the same things that we all talk about and that I'm hearing at this table. With those 14 years ago, with those 18 examining attorneys, we now have a workforce that has over 5,000, almost 5,400 people teleworking between 1 and 4 days a week. And it's really just an incredible flexible workplace. People want to work at the Patent and Trademark Office. Again, it's not just about telework. It's about the fact that we can work anywhere between 5:30 in the morning and 10:30 at night.
Well, and one of the important things we used during the last snowstorm that hit Washington, which, you know, I'm the guy who gets to close the government, so it, I'm also the guy that they toast when I reopen it. But so it works both ways. One day you're a hero, the next day you're a dog. But the Patent and Trademark Office maintained 85% productivity during that event when the federal government was closed, hypothetically.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so it was amazing in their Washington operation. So it was they're one of the leaders in this, and I want to commend them. Let's move back to the corporate sector now. I want to get a sense We've heard a couple of ideas from some of the players. What are the other best practices, success models that, you know, someone hasn't already said that you'd want it, we want to get out there? What are we?
You know, we won't talk about, I think, again, we've talked about telecommuting, reduced work hours, flexible work arrangements. We also have job sharing. And in our industry, that's important. Yeah. We're in client service. And there are going to be some critical roles that somebody has to be, you know, performing at all times. So that's another way we've been able to accomplish that flexibility for people and having individuals in job sharing roles. But I'll tell you, you know, you can have a lot of flexible work opportunities, and the question is how many people are really comfortable taking advantage of those work arrangements for a lot of different reasons. Promotion, evaluation, rating, what are the impacts going to be on me? Especially at Pricewaterhouse, we have a very competitive work environment. People in their careers move and get promoted relatively quickly. And so those are some challenges. So one of the new things that we've actually introduced to allow individuals to be comfortable with taking, you know, either taking advantage of the flexibility or taking off the time that we want to afford them without being concerned is this year looking differently at how we evaluate individuals, for example, who have needed flexibility in their work life in that year and haven't been at work for, let's say, 6 months. Whether that's because of a maternity leave, whether that's because of paternity leave, whether that's they're taking care of their elderly parents for whatever reason, and taking that out of the equation, whereby, you know, if you're gone for more than 6 months, you're going to come back, you're going to get the same rating as you did last year. You get to opt into that to give them that peace of mind that we really do want you to take advantage of this because you're going to return, because you're going to be a more productive and a more loyal employee coming back. So that's, you know, those are some of the things. Plus giving people, for example, we have a full circle program. As a mother, you can leave for up to 5 years. You can dial down, leave for up to 5 years, leave for 5 years, take care of your children, and come back to PricewaterhouseCoopers in the same level that you left. So that, again, gives individuals that comfort that they can actually take advantage of some of these programs.
How many companies have sabbaticals, corporate, that are part of their workforce?
Yeah. For everybody here, that's
interesting. I would make a point that, you know, I think you can, there's a lot of us have examples of all the different kinds of programs that you support. But, you know, and in response to a question, my company supports work-life balance. 90% of our employees answer positively that question. And I think, and I can't take credit for this, it came later, but have reinforced it, is it starts with making sure you have a plan about changing your culture. Mm-hmm. And it's the question you ask. How do you get that manager mindset?
Right.
And culture is a softer thing. Like, it's easy to do training on here's all the different things you can do to have a flexible workplace. You know, it's kind of education about information and policy and practice. But cultural change, cultural transformation is important. It has to happen before all those things get taken advantage of. It's the whole thing about giving yourself permission, and it's also about the manager understanding how this could be a powerful tool for them. And cultural transformation is a best practice, and it starts with, first of all, what we saw from Doug is the CEO is going to support this and understands how important it is to the business. It starts with symbolism. You know, at First Tennessee, before I got there, there's a famous story that rides through the culture about the day the CEO took a very restrictive occasional absence policy and literally burned it and filmed it being burned and said, we're not going to rely on policy and procedure to decide how work is going to be organized. We're going to let managers have the flexibility. So you have CEO support, you have acts of symbolism, you have communication, and you have training. And the training isn't just about here's the different options, because we all know, you know, we all have job sharing, we all have flex time, we all have compressed workplaces and telecommuting. Not a lot of new ideas there. But it's about getting at the underlying assumptions of those managers in the trenches. Maybe some would say not as enlightened as some of us. I don't know. That seems like that's not a positive thing to say. But getting them to understand the assumptions they have about work and about results and what people's motivations are, their behavior, you know, kind of the old McGregor's theory, X theory, Y kind of view, you know, really having them get in a conversation about what do your belief about people and motivates them and why do they come to work. And when you get at that, you all of a sudden get your managers thinking very differently about work, about results, and they then began to clamor for and call for more tools and flexibility about how do I get more out of my workforce.
See, I think that is so core. to how you actually make this something other than a poster campaign.
That's exactly
right. I agree.
That, you know, part of the dialogue we try to have with our managers is, what is it that you're afraid of that you're going to lose control over or ability to manage?
Key questions.
You know, and so the early on what we heard from our managers is, if I can't see the person, how do I know they're working? You know, if you think about how in the past we've really focused on the role of the manager, it's been to assure that activity is occurring that produces a result. And this really forces a shift where the managers now have to understand how to evaluate the outcome and the results produced by means which may not be completely visible to you, that you may not fully understand, but that in fact produce the right result for your organization and for the company. And the interesting thing, to your point, is once people break through on that and they understand it and they can see how, you know, providing this enables better results, what we discover is our own managers now in the surveys that I talk about will say to you, they accept and see the value of these flexibility policies more than the employees do in that regard.
The point you made about the CEO, I think, is about one of the companies that's done well on this, and it began with a guy, some of you may know, named John Bryan at Sara Lee. John was somebody who followed, indeed, by a woman CEO, and I knew if anybody would do it, John would. John would never say, I'm going now, or something. He'd say, I'm going to my kids' play. He was just, I'm going to take my daughter to the doctor. I mean, he really did live it. And it's those things as well as the larger things. The account, and another thing we haven't mentioned that might be worth thinking about is accountability.
Yes.
That is, and I know a number of your companies have that kind of thing. It's not just we're going to do it, but asking the question when you see, as you evaluate across an organization, that there's this unit here that has never had a woman, never had a person of color, and somebody on top just has a chat with the person, the guy who runs that silo, and says, say, I've noticed. That's the way you take your numbers and work with it.
Bruce Pfau from KPMG. I just a couple of observations, and then I wanted to just mention a couple of very micro best practices that that we have found have helped us, and they're easy to implement. The first observation is just sort of coming off of what you've said, and that is that I think that this wave that you're talking about, or this tsunami, that flexibility is going to be in a lot of ways like diversity. The more flexible we are, the more people that are taking advantage of it, like the CEO, the more flexible we're going to become. The more women and Americans and Asians that are around the table, the more likely it is that you're going to have more diversity around the table in the future. And I think the same thing is going to work with flexibility. Two, just not policy kinds of programs, but sort of in the trenches programs. We have a thing called team of choice. We're an employer of choice. We wanted to bring it down to the field level, to the engagement team level with our professionals. It's just simple training of managers to help set work schedules as a team every week so that people know when that this week on Wednesday I need to take off. Who's going to help cover for me? Who's going to work late this night? Who's during our busy season? Who's going to take off this weekend? And that a very simple and concrete thing, and setting sort of work contracts in the beginning with teams, has dramatically improved satisfaction around predictability and flexibility with our professionals in the field. And the second is a thing that that we have that's called shared leave. We already provide like 25 to 30 days, depending on how long you've been with us, of personal time off that people can use for various reasons. But sometimes they exhaust that, and we allow our employees to donate their unused leave to other employees. And it is just beyond belief. It doesn't take us more than a couple of hours if somebody needs shared leave time to put a request in, and through the social network, within a half a day, we have 40, 50, 60 hours donated to that person to handle an unexpected illness, an elderly parent that has a problem, whatever. And those are easy to implement and that have had a big effect for us.
It's great ideas.
There's something about sustainability of the programs too, which is, I think you get a big push when you do this initially, and you get a lot of senior level conversations, and you do get the posters, and you get the internal website set up, you throw a lot of tools at it. But what you see over time is that there's something else that has to kind of connect to make this thing sustainable. And it's something a couple people have brought up, it's around building community. Because I think what happens is that as everybody continues to be, this is a watch out, so as everybody continues to work from home a little bit more, or their paths don't cross as often, or the teams are outside of the same geographic area, there's gotta be something that still maintains and reinforces that culture. And so however you do it, whether through its employee groups, or whether it's through online groups, I think what you need to do is continue to have that constant connection and sharing of best practices, and everybody feels like they're in it together, that they're not alone when they're working at home. Yeah. And I think for American Express, it will be something that we'll always have our eye on, is how do we maintain that culture when people, you don't see people all the time.
And I think that in many ways is a generational thing. I mean, you know, X and Y, pretty much that's not an issue. They know how to do community and networking and social in a virtual world.
But to maintain the culture within that, they may have their own social networks, but to make them create that business network.
How do we bridge and build into that?
Well, if you think about it, one of the ways that business networks have been historically formed is I work next to you, we work in the same office, in the same branch, it's FaceTime, we go out and we hang out after work. I learn what I can trust you about, I know what you're good at, and you learn the same thing about me, and I know what your expertise is. We come together not only when we have crisis, but when there are, you know, positive things to talk about. Those things in the human behavior haven't changed significantly, but the risk with flexible programs is you wind up, you know, preventing people in the ordinary course from forming those. So focus on creating ways for people to find out what their colleagues' expertise is. You know, for us, again, because so many of our folks are remotely, and the center of the organization assumes that the people you'll work with on an ordinary basis, more often than not, aren't going to be in the same site, same facility, same state, maybe even the same country as you. Mm-hmm. So you've got to give people tools, collaborative tools, repositories that people can catalog their experiences and information that people can access to find out. So who knows about a particular software product or an integration capability or technology, and provide them the technology and the means to actually engage each other, you know, so that they can share insights and work together and form those teams.
We've sort of, you know, building on that and sort of following up with this notion of generational differences. What we're discussing now is sort of this, you know, as comfortable as Y and X are in the virtual world, what we're finding is when they enter the face-to-face world, they're generally incompetent. I mean, they lack absolutely basic interpersonal skills. It was funny. I was with an interview with someone last night, and they said, well, I chose a school with hard skills, not soft skills, like Syracuse and Harvard. Well, I said, Syracuse, and the woman on the other side who's interviewing him said, Harvard. And I said, you've got to be careful in an interview on this thing. You know, what we're finding is what we're suggesting is almost sort of a joint mentorship program.
That's true.
Where
yes.
the older generation, which has, you know, excess of skills on the face-to-face and interpersonal levels, and a dearth on the virtual, you know, that they can exchange,
exactly.
you know, the generations can exchange their skills across that and lift both up. And that's sort of, we're playing with how to do that sort of joint mentorship or two-way street mentorship.
Yeah.
Than the old-fashioned mentorship of just a one-way approach. So
it's almost that you go back to it's not an either or, it's an and. You have to reach that and with that, because
absolutely.
We watch folks who are very comfortable using technology, and then we try to get them off of technology to have a conversation, and you go, wait a minute, in order for them to trust that I understand how they communicate, I have to become more proficient at social networking and those tools, and they have to trust that I might have something offline of value to them, mm-hmm. and integrating those as part of the conversation. So it's not either you're online or you're offline. It's you have to do both.
you know, having responsibility at Sodexo for both mentoring and flexibility. It's amazing how these topics overlap. And if I can circle back to the comments about being results-oriented, I think about a year and a half ago before we officially launched our flexibility initiative, it was more of an accommodation focus because somebody had a particular need. And through launching an official initiative, we said, let's get rid of the reason why somebody wants it. And it's really about making a business-based pitch for how this would potentially, whatever the arrangement happens to be, but to add value to individual performance, the organization, or our clients and customers. And that shifted the conversation, and I think that helps to make managers more comfortable. And then I think I've heard also putting the onus on the employee to initiate and come up with their own solution and process. You know,
we found, like, when we first launched flexible work arrangements years ago, they just weren't scalable because there was this stigma that kind of went with it, and there were really viewed as kind of one-off situations and very specialized to that one circumstance, and other people didn't think that was them. And so I think with our mass career customization framework, it's really been, it's been a challenge because everybody has to do it, including our CEO. And I think what's been helping with the cultural transformation is, it's more than a program. We've tried to change the model, but at the same time, our CEO's got a profile out there too that's very, very public, so that people could see that his career wasn't just straight up the ladder either. It's really what we call the corporate lattice, and people's careers really do ebb and flow. And so, as a result, people are not going to always want to, you know, be at work all the time physically. They're going to need to take breaks, not just because we're finding as many men, you know, want this flexibility. In fact, they seem more stressed based on some recent survey data around the work-life balance issues than women are. And I think because it's new to them having the dual family situation or the dual income situation. And so, you know, we know that the traditional model is really, the family model is no longer here. So I think, you know, it's really, back to your point about the culture, but I think it's, you have to keep driving it, and you have to drive it from the top. And one of the things that we've learned through the years, especially with our women's initiative, is you have to keep reinforcing it. You're never really there. And what you can imagine, and similar probably to PwC and all the ones that have a partnership model, you have like 4,000 partners going, oh my God, people are gonna dial down and they're not gonna work. You know, that same fear we talked about. And what we really found is that 2/3 of the people that had what we call a customized profile were actually dialing up. Mm-hmm. They were actually wanted to accelerate, and only 1/3 of that third were dialing down. But we don't know if some of that was attributed to the recession and fear. So we have to, you know, we're committed to this model. We're going to have to keep working it over time to see if we can get about 30% of our population doing this, because that's really the goal.
The challenge is really that myth that you just talked about. This myth that somehow if people are remote or if they're on a flexible work arrangement, that they're watching TV.
Yeah, they're not being productive.
They're not working. When in fact, I mean, even when you look at your own behavior, I mean, the few days that I get to work at my apartment, I'm at my computer by 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have to commute. I didn't have to shower. I didn't have to shave.
Keep your fuzzy slippers on.
Exactly. Yeah.
I have my wife calling me saying, "Are you ever going to get away from there?" So the idea that somehow that your productivity is going down is a complete myth. And I remember studies from American Express, even with your customer service operators and so forth, that the flexibility provided more productivity and faster speed of answer.
Yeah, but what we hear is people, instead of saying, "I don't have anything to do today, so I'm going to go work from home," it's like, "I have so much to do, I'm going to go home and work."
I'm going to go from home because nobody will be coming in.
So it's a paradigm shift.
We heard that during the snowstorm. People said, "My God, I got so much work done."
I know.
But it's not just sort of a phony irony. I mean, it's true.
Well, it's logical if you think about it. I mean, the story that you tell about what happened in Washington in the snowstorm, we hear over and over and over again. We have clients that we do what we call business continuity services for, where the systems go down, and part of the recovery plan is to enable their employees working at home or remotely to come back up. And then almost every time we do that, we get this kind of interesting ping back from the client saying, "I thought productivity was going to hit the, you know," and it went up. Mm-hmm. Or it was as good as or better than it is in the normal case. And as one CFO at a financial institution in a major city said to me, so it makes me wonder, why am I spending all this money for this office
space?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But to that point, I would just say, you know, it still has to be win-win for both the company and the employee.
Yep.
And there are some employees for whom working
absolutely
at home is just
right
not a good
exactly
deal.
Right.
I mean,
very true.
They're just their personality type, their work style, et cetera.
But then you offer them a broader portfolio of yeah things to, that
right
fit into back to your comment
right
about the life cycle
right
of where people are. You at least have to have more than one option
exactly
that addresses
it's
those.
Just,
a,
just as the
style
one size fits all workplace of the past
right
doesn't work, the
right
one size fits all flexibility doesn't work.
And that's an important point. Somebody asked a question about best practices, and the best practice is to enable organizations, managers, and employees to respond flexibly to what the employee needs at the time and what the drivers of the
right
business are. The things that we thought about in terms of flexibility, and I've heard several people said it when we started this journey, have evolved because the technologies involved, the nature of the workforce has evolved and continues to evolve. We now, in this recession, we have more women as the sole breadwinners than we had. Those will require us to be flexible in terms of how we respond and the programs we build. So, you know, this notion of trying to be enable that flexibility, enable organizations to be that flexible is really critical.
Let me just jump in one quick second. A real good case study that goes to this point is, it's just so perfect on point, I want to put it out there, is we had an office in Pittsburgh, 65 people. And I was paying $250,000 a year for that lease space for that office. It was a problem-solving telephone center. And we had been working on moving to allowing employees to work from home and distant management of that, but we still had 10 employees that really wanted to be in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we were able to do was actually find office space closer to their home, so they were happy in office space. I got the rest we negotiated an agreement. They are now working from home. I've canceled the lease and saved the taxpayer $250,000. So, you know, you can just, that's just one little tiny operation
yeah, exactly
in a small agency of the federal government. You play that out,
yeah,
you can imagine, you know, how many people are thinking of building buildings or expanding buildings now in the federal government that we might be able to, those may be cost saved to the taxpayer if we can
right
do this right.
And higher levels of employee satisfaction.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Has noticed a decline in demand for space.
Yeah.
Standardizing for the economy because each individual organization needs less space.
That's
fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Well, and you add in there, most people have done some of this right now, but we now have 100% hoteling,
yeah,
right? So everybody goes in and it works like a hotel, right? You
mm-hmm
dial in
yeah
the internet, you
yeah
make your reservation, and you know you're there on the time. That you know that allows you. Because you also have the problem of even the people who are there, you know, are not using their office certain times and things like that. So just the space, I mean, I think we have about 1/10 the footprint in the United States that we
absolutely
use to.
Absolutely,
well,
we're there too.
Well, as a patent and trademark office, we do hoteling as well with our trademark examining attorneys and patent examiners. And we have enabled the agency to avoid the cost of about $11 million of real estate since these hoteling programs started being in full force. So it's really a phenomenal initiative.
Let me go over here. Some people who haven't had a chance to join yet, let me.
Sure, I had a question about best practices of the firms here. And you had mentioned this at Pricewaterhouse.
Yes.
Dealing with making employees feel comfortable to take advantage of the flexibility you offer. And the specific example you provided was the 6 months that you're off on maternity leave, you won't count that in the evaluation. Are there any best practices that people have used to encourage people to use telecommuting or feel comfortable using telecommuting? Because I imagine a lot of employees are fearful if they're not getting FaceTime with the boss
mm-hmm
that's going to affect their career in the long
yeah
run.
This doesn't relate to FaceTime, but actually in Australia we pay people to work from home.
Okay,
but the reason is because we get rid of the real estate. And
yeah
so, and what we found is that for a very minimal amount of money, you know, like almost like 1/20th of what we pay for space, people are saying that's a good trade-off. And so it's kind of interesting that if you want to change behaviors, you know, what is the things that actually will do that? And
that's
so,
a good message to convince people.
You're saving the company money, and so here,
right.
If you're passing on those savings.
Passing it on, and they feel like they're doing something good for the company. They feel like they're doing something good for the shareholder, and they're getting a benefit.
I actually had a similar question because I also do policy here in BC over at Georgetown Law School, and we've spent a lot of time looking at the data of who has access, and certainly. The companies around this table have surfaced again and again as being innovators. And whenever I hear you all in a group, it's pretty inspiring. The question I had is though, you know, we've been talking sectorally. You mentioned firms, you know, financial services, accounting, all around the table. But lots of companies have, for example, a corporate campus. Mm-hmm. So it may be a manufacturing company like you just heard downstairs. There is still a corporate culture there. So putting aside for a moment the issues around hourly workers, which I know another group is really looking at in terms of retail and manufacturing, still, why is it that I see consistently the same names of companies surface? And how can we get what you've all learned out there a little more?
Because it's not, I mean, in some ways we're all touting it as a virtue, but it's a necessity. In other words, people want it. Our employees want this flexibility, and so we're competing. We're all competing on the flexibility playing field. If the best talent wants this flexibility, then we ultimately have to provide it or not be able to attract and retain the best talent. And the side benefits of the productivity and the cost savings and the lowering of the carbon footprint make it sort of a quadruple win, but it's a market necessity.
I would add, you know, in our organization, I'm sure everybody, in order for us to continue to be innovative, and you know, for our industry, PricewaterhouseCoopers, to solve those complex business problems that our clients come to us for, we need diversity. And as John was saying, you know, in order for us to be able to really build on that diversity of our organization, we have to. It's a business imperative not only to have a diverse organization, but to have a flexible, you know, organization that can feed, you know, the needs of our employees.
So let me turn to Karen for a second, who's from the Chamber, to sort of maybe go into this question a little bit more broadly. What's your experience, Karen, with sort of the phenomenon between leaders, followers, and in private sector? What are the main barriers left between those who where this is not, you know, an accepted practice?
So in the honor of not being shameless, thanks to Kathy Christensen at the Sloan Foundation, the Chamber's been engaged through ICW and with the Families and Work Institute, Nellen Galinsky, and the Twiga Foundation. Many of these corporations have been represented to really highlight those best practices. And that's where we've really concentrated our efforts. What is working among employers? How do you get that information out? And someone said, you know, how do you go beyond firms and go to smaller corporations, mid-sized and even very small businesses, to demonstrate that this is being done? But it, you know, what we hear from our members, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's really having that open communication, figuring out what's going to work for the individual employee, and equally, what's going to work for the bottom line of the business, and making sure that those two efforts are in line. So we've done this publication. It's in the second year. We'll do another one, continue to expand it. And it's great, I think, because it's indexed by industry type and industry sector, by size of employer. And it gives you that, in a nutshell, this is what these employers are doing. And I think the question is, how do we better share all of the information around the table with each of you and with your peers who may not understand how this can be used or how it can be adapted to their own work environment?
But that especially is a key point that you've made, because even though we talk about best practices, what's best practices for IBM or American Express can't be just imported whole hog into your organization without understanding the nuances of the cultural effect of your particular organization, so that's huge.
Yeah, being able to share that information. This is the 2009 guide to bold new ideas.
We'll make sure we'll include this in the package. If you'll let us, we'll, is it okay to put it on the web thing for that?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. We will.
And we will do that. On our website with Business and Professional Women's Foundation, we've been working for the last 5 years in building best practices cases with a variety. So we've got private firms, we've got small employers. So we do the whole continuum and just keep sharing that information.
I think one of the things the First Lady's office has challenged us to do is to come up with sort of a crossroad of information that we can provide both private and public sector so that we can take advantage, we can have all of these links. Absolutely. And if you all are willing, I mean, obviously it has to be voluntary from your part, but if you'd be willing to share a link with us on a site that we could build, then, you know, and we'd make it open, you know, that people could access that information,
Absolutely.
It'd be wonderful. So that would be very helpful.
I have a question. It seems that a lot of the conversation has been around recruitment and retention and those being the primary drivers. But with the aging workforce, and perhaps not with Accenture, with such a young workforce, but perhaps with some of the other firms, with the aging workforce, how much is knowledge transfer an issue, and how much is your aging workforce also wanting to have more flexible work arrangements, and do you see this as another way in to provide more flexibility to meet those needs and also meet the business needs for, you know, maintaining that institutional knowledge and for also ensuring the knowledge transfer?
We're able to retain our older workers for longer. That's what we want. We don't want that knowledge walking out the door, and we need those folks to help mentor and partner with our incoming patent examiners and our incoming trademark attorneys. So I think it goes both ways, really. You know, you talk a little bit about the new folks graduating from college. They value their free time, their flexibility, more than a large salary, believe it or not. We find that in the federal government. We find that at the agency. We want those folks to come and to stay. So we have to step up to the plate and be able to offer the same kind of workplace flexibilities that you folks sitting around the table can do. So, yes, absolutely agree with that.
There is, I'm going to keep trying to make this point. I don't know if I'm being clear. In addition to the notion of attraction and retention, if you build an organization that has the capacity to manage itself flexibly, there is this really incredible thing you get about connecting really smart people mm-hmm. who aren't sitting in the same location, and you build this culture of collaboration and engagement that really results in a lot more innovation, personal satisfaction on the part of the people in the organization, better delivery of service to the clients, and in fact for us, we started this journey on this notion of creating opportunities to attract and retain women. Now, let's be confess that. Right, because women were the primary caregivers in the family, they continue to be, and we needed to find ways to enable them to do both. Well, as the families have shifted, the notion of giving everybody in the family responsibility, you got sandwich generations where men and women are taking care of parents and children at the same time, those things continue to be true. But once you've built the capacity and the culture to do that, you get this other thing that's really, really, I think, as powerful or more powerful than that retention and attraction, which is this ability to do stuff that you could never do when you were limited to who you could see and who you contacted every day.
Sort of like creativity squared.
Exactly. I mean, I have this example play itself out all the time where we've got a critical project. We're looking for people who know how and have already done a piece of work that is responsive to a client need. And one person's sitting in New York and the other one's sitting in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And if the culture is in a way that enables people to find the person with that skill, to engage them through technology, communications, or otherwise, bring them to the team, design and deliver the degree to which you produce better solutions, you do them faster, you strengthen people's relationships and connections, is just incredible. And I think that's where, you asked the question earlier, where's the future of this? You said something. Firms that have been doing this and have built that foundation are going to continue to yield benefits from it.
Can I just add? Let me just add two things to what you said because it's perfect. You add to that the fact that more and more of us have to collaborate mm-hmm. with other partners to get whatever we need to have done.
Right.
It used to be that collaboration broke down because people weren't sitting face to face. Well, now that I've learned in my own company how to not sit face-to-face and to collaborate stuff, it's more easy for me to have a virtual community with, for us, our alliance partners and other people around the world that we need to deliver our solutions. So you improve the communication there. It also allows you to have more flexibility in your workforce. Mm-hmm. So it's flexibility to the ultimate extent is, because I'm used to collaboration and bringing people into the tools and bringing them into the environment, I can grow my workforce by adding temporary workers or people that want to be on contract or that are semi-retired or all the rest of those much easier than I could before.
Yeah, that ecosystem
expands. And you add globalization to that, which makes it all absolutely essential. I mean, not only Albuquerque, how about Bangladesh?
Let me give opportunity to somebody who hasn't had a chance yet.
I'd like to bring us back to an earlier conversation earlier about the flexible schedules, and you yourself said you'll send an email at 3 o'clock in the morning. You don't expect your staff to respond right away, but there is staff is inclined, if they know, to jump on it and see if they can respond. It puts a, so I just wonder about, I think that you mentioned that as well, it makes it harder for them to adhere to a regular work schedule, and then they also, you know, worry about their career path, you know, when they're up for review or evaluation. Not answering that email in the middle of the night when somebody else was able to, is that going to get them?
Well, part of that is having that healthy conversation that Ron was talking about and setting the boundaries around that.
Right.
Because if once you have a conversation, Bruce sent me an email at 3 o'clock, I would go, that's Bruce, and he'll get his response when I'm...
Exactly.
You know, yeah, and you start having those conversations.
Right.
And my staff knows that I'm an insomniac, so I will do things at weird hours in the morning. If they're up, I'm like, what the heck are you doing up? Because I'm not. That's not my expectation.
You learn.
So you have those clear conversations.
What you send them that email.
Right.
The other way you can control that is I don't just randomly send these out to any of the 5,000 employees. There are two chiefs of staff. And so no. But it's a good example though, because I recognize that tendency. So what I do is sort of I channel. I know, like, you know. So it's like, so Jennifer or Liz would get, you know, one of them would get this, and that way they know to process it at whatever time that they knew it. But it's on their list now to do. And that way, because they know I have a great short-term memory, but a horrible long one, you know, it's not lost. It doesn't go into the ether. And so, but I would, I think any good manager would know, for God's sakes, if I'm getting up to just, you know, to an employee at OPM and zipping, all of a sudden they get a 3:30, it would cause, you know, heart attack. So it would be wrong to do that. I think there's almost an ethical thing that would prevent you.
These devices, all, this is really something we've learned, really important. They all have off switches.
Yeah.
So one of the things I do, because I'm an insomniac, I'll do mail odd hours. I did one late last night, and then I was going to hit the send button, and it dawned on me I could just as easily turn the system off, and tomorrow morning when I get up, it's sitting in my draft box, hit the send button. You know, I don't have to be on instant messaging, or if I am, it's, you know, controlled in a way that only a limited range of people actually see me on this. And with my team and my leadership team, we've got a contract. You know, when you're on and you're visible, you're green.
Right.
There's a little green button beside your name. So we have this thing that we say, it's not cool to be green after a certain hour.
You're off the grid.
These are management techniques. If you behave and the leadership behaves like that and sets the standards, you can actually, it's not easy, but it is doable.
But you learn people's preferences.
Exactly.
Yes.
Your schedules, right? You know the guy that is, I know the people on my staff that they put their kids to bed and then they go to their computer, and I know I'm going to get a response at midnight because that's when he catches up.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy goes to his computer before he goes to the gym, and then there's a blackout period from, you know, 6 to 7:30 when he's there or she's there. And I think you learn about, and part of it is accommodating, and that's what flexibility is, right? Being flexible.
Yeah.
So
and leadership behavior, because if John sent an email to me and then didn't ask me about it, I would know, well, you know, he was just sending the email. But if you as a leader send an email at 3 o'clock and then the next morning go, well, did you get my email?
Yes.
that sells me what you really
have to do. That's very true.
So you set the boundaries, you manage the expectations.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things, though, is kind of changing your culture to be really about results. Mm-hmm. And kind of what gets measured gets done. So it's kind of the, you know, if people think that face time is going to be part of their evaluation, then they're going to feel that that's important. Right. I think you have to have that transparency that that's not really what gets counted. I know that, you know, it's hard to make that transition. It's a journey. But it's really around that isn't what counts.
Yeah.
The results are what counts. And that's where I think that communication and transparency around it. And again, I like to send emails late too, but it's more for me, you know, just like get it off my, but I like the idea. I've learned something today. I know, exactly. But you know what? I like the idea of turning it off and sending it in the morning. I mean, you know, it doesn't
look so
ridiculous.
You guys should all get together.
Yeah, exactly. I know what I'm going to be doing.
It's not just sending the note, right? It's, you know, I think for a long time we were hesitant to talk about why we needed flexibility or why we were going to be out of the office. And again, as leaders, as managers, right. You know, what I do is if I'm sending an email at 6 in the morning, I'm sending it because I probably can't be in the office first thing because I have to go to my kid's school. We now have a, you know, teacher-parent conference. And I tell them that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be in the office early today. I have, you know, whatever that may be. And so I'm sending this email. We'll talk about it later. And so just talking about why you're going to be out.
Yeah.
Why I need to work from home. You know, I'm a tax preparer by trade. That's what I've done. I'm letter energy tax practice. I have a lot of different responsibilities. I have two children as well. And so there are times where, you know, I need to be home for a variety of reasons, and I tell people that. I socialize that. You know, I come from a cultural background where taking your vacation was really important. And in my industry, taking vacation was, you're going to be gone for a day?
Yeah.
No, I take 3 weeks of vacation every summer because that is what my family has always done, and that's accepted. So it's really sharing.
It's sharing.
Right.
We call
why
that compulsive,
you're doing some things you're
We call that
doing.
Compulsive transparency, and honestly, it helps because it really forces that conversation.
I read a book about 7 years ago that in my own journey was pretty profound on me, and it's written by a businessman out of Brazil called The 7-Day Weekend. And so everybody says 7-day weekend. But
I
use it for people all the time because his philosophy, and this is 7 years ago, but his philosophy was we've let work permeate, we were just saying the BlackBerry, all those other things, all of our life. Why can't we let some of the weekend activities, some of the other things that we need to do, and he tells stories about people that do their date nights on Thursday afternoon because that was the best time they could do it and stuff like that. So I think if you could talk about that philosophical mindset set shift with the people, it helps.
I just want to say that what I'm hearing here, which is what we have learned, is that you have to be really flexible about flexible policies.
Correct.
And if you start to categorize people too much, then you can see everybody here has a different work style. I'm sure everybody has different sleep patterns and eating patterns and learning patterns and speech patterns. And so what it is, it's really being open and having a culture that accepts diversity and differences.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you start taking it away from, we have four policies.
Don't codify it too much.
Because it needs to be flexible. Because
I love the example of burning the regulation button.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great example.
We may have a fire.
Exactly.
The other watch out that we have to do.
Be careful, it could burn down the city. Right. So many regulations.
We have to have expansive definitions because as people talk about family, you know, I don't have young kids, and oftentimes people say, well, flexibility is more families. I'm like, no, sometimes I just need to be, and you have to make sure that your definition doesn't exclude people in the process in terms of it's not for them.
Right.
And particularly frame it around, here's life cycle around your career. That's
you know, it's what I was going to build on. This other best practice or program we have is called Personal Pursuits, and it's for men and women who very similar want to take up to 5 years off. We just had our first two people come back. One was a man who was only 26 and took a year off to go teach English in China and came back. And the other one was a woman who was gone for 4 years raising 3 kids. But, I mean, just the profiles are so different, and I think that, you know, it's really not what you're going to do during that 5 years, is that you want that time and you want to be able to come back. And I think that.
And now you have an employee that speaks Chinese.
Exactly.
You know, and you didn't have to pay for it.
Exactly. He's incredibly.
We can capture these testimonials and case studies just like we're trying to capture a database of them for other organizations to look at. It makes it more real for people. That,
exactly.
Hey, this is an organization that endorses and supports these things.
Well, he's definitely Gen Y.
Let me bring us back to just time clock reality. We only have about 25 minutes left. we wanted to leave time to sort of shift to that over the horizon piece now. So I think we've had a good discussion on the best practices. So that no one feels shut off, we are going to build this, we're going to work with the White House to see if we can assemble sort of an interactive web-based situation where we can continue to share this best practice as we go forward and across some of the great work that's being done out there. But let's now just for the close, if we could, and this is open to everybody here, is sort of, you know, what's over the horizon, all right? We've talked about, we have here, you know, the leaders who are on the cutting edge right now on these issues of workplace flexibility. What do you all see as what's coming? What's over the horizon that, you know, or the crazy idea that so far people would say, oh my God, we're never going to go there, but, you know, are there those that are out there? What do folks think about that? And I throw that broad.
I think this is not that much of a soothsaying. I think that we're all going to see two things. One, technology transforming this in a way that in some ways we can't even anticipate yet. You know, somebody said earlier in the plenary session, well, you can't have a teacher in a classroom virtually. I mean, if you could have a doctor doing a heart transplant robotically, then maybe you can have a teacher teaching. Maybe there'll be a holographic image of a teacher. Who knows what's on the horizon, but the video and webcam technology is going to be gigantic, even just in the next 2 or 3 years, right? And I think the other thing that we're going to see, because of real estate and carbon reduction emphasis, is a move away from all our big midtown offices and to pods, and, like you would, someone was describing, you know, closer to home. I mean, it's going to be more likely that the big four will have a Staten Island landing spot in Brooklyn and a downtown. You know, that will be much more informal rather than these vertical cubes where everybody has to descend on Midtown and burn up a lot of gas. But no one wants to do it. That's what will drive it.
They've described, in sort of being a lover of history, sort of two great periods of American history of sort of the expansion west, and then the transition to urban America, sort of from, you know, where our society is concentrated in these urban areas. I wonder if what you're talking about is the third wave is going to be a decentralization of America. You know, it'll be interesting.
Home is the most decentralized, right? But I think it'll be more neighborhoods. You know, Greenwich Village,
But I don't think it'll be a decentralization. I think it'll be a shrinkage. Mm-hmm. I think that most companies will still need a central spot, right, as you've done, but in the form of like hoteling as opposed to large corporate centers. I mean, I think it still serves a function.
I think, to Bruce's point, there'll be more virtual corporations where you live second life. You actually go to work as your avatar. Yeah. And you have the same interaction that you would have if you were in a physical building.
First life, you're on the golf course?
Only if you get it right.
I just think that work is going to be more distributed, and I think that people are not, as you had mentioned, you know, you're going to get away from living in the cities. There are a lot of folks that, you know, as much as we love Washington, D.C. and the surrounding area, not everybody wants to live here. I think people are going to be more distributed. They can communicate virtually, if you will, with the mothership. I think we're going to see a return to more family time, more unit time, as a result of this distributed.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a better connection from flexibility to health and well-being.
Absolutely.
And you're starting to see edges of it now, but I think that there's going to be a big drive around it not being purely a productivity and a kind of reconnect back to home. It's really about personal health and well-being, both physical and mental health. And I think we're seeing edges of that right now. So I think there'll be a huge push around it.
The baby boomers want to live forever.
Yeah.
And with that, I think that organizations are going to have to be more systematic around phased and partial retirement than perhaps we've been in the past.
Well, there's a big talent shortage that we all know is coming too, because there isn't another generation the size of the baby boomers. And so I think this is going to force flexibility, of course, but it's also going to, we're going to have four generations or five in the workplace. And so I think when we look at what the model is going to look like, we're going to have to, I think there will be these pods or mothership kind of concepts, but I think the composition of those pods will be very different. It's not going to all be like a Gen Y pod over there. And you know, I mean, I think they're going to, there's going to still be a need for people to connect physically and humanly with each other. We can't, I do think that we're going to go as far as we can with technology, but then we're going to want some of that FaceTime back because
Yeah,
not for promotions as much as the need to connect with a human being, I think, is still out there.
So I think in the short term, what you're actually going to see is what more what I call hybrids. So, you know, you have in our business software creation teams. A lot of that can be done flexibly, mobily, remotely. But the concept of a brainstorming session as a way to drive innovation is so important. That, you know, you're going to see mixed models where people, you know, have both defined times, but also where we structure the organization in ways that we bring people back together, but not in the ways we think about now, because I think the nature of work itself is going to change. The nature of the relationship between what we call employers and employees is going to change, so that the kind of standard ways we think about employment categories, this technology, this flexibility, and all the other things that you described are going to force us to rethink them in ways that are going to profoundly impact how we work together, what the communities are, and, you know, and how we organize the work and the accomplishment of the task in the company. And that's, some of that's knowable, some of it is not. I mean, we talk about, think about how so much of this happened because of the improvement in telecommunications infrastructure. Well, how many of you have high definition televisions at home that now make it, you know, almost like you're looking face to face with people? How does that technology and all of that adapt in ways that fundamentally change the way we work? I don't think we know.
Well, and I'm sorry, the millennials research that we just finished, they're going to continue to push us there,
yeah.
Right? Because their number one thing is, and it was quoted earlier this morning, they do look at the employer and what the employer offers and the tools and the technology and what they're allowed to do, how flexible they are, as a key characteristic of it. Second, they the things that they use in their personal life and the things they use in their business life are blending together. So many of them figure out how to use some technology that we don't necessarily, from a security perspective, want them to use, but they use there. The other thing I'd tell you, John, just so you get that policy burning party going, 28% of this research body that we did, the people, millennials, did not know what a policy was.
That's why you need a policy.
They may have taken that to another level, right? Which is,
well, I think we're going to have to deal with the mobility of people too. In other words, we know that the next generation, in particular, is going to have more than one job, you know, and five or six. And so I think as flexibility, I think, it becomes table stakes. When, you know, everybody's going to have more, then it's going to be becoming, well, then what's going to be different?
Right.
What's going to be the next thing that's going to actually attract and retain the people that right now we're thinking this is because we have to and we think it's better for everybody, all generations, to have it, but we also have to think about that. And I think the globalization and the fact that so much of our work, just like, you know, it's not even done in the U.S. anymore. You know, even though a lot of our things, our concerns are U.S.-centric, you know, all of that is just a picture of kind of what it's going to be like and how do you continue that. So I think those are forces that we're going to have to
I think that a real, you know, a cautionary note is the need for boundary setting.
Exactly.
Because, you know, the fact is for many of us, we do almost the equivalent of a day's worth of work before we get in the office. And so, you know, with people working across time zones, people could be working 24/7 to an extent that's not even conceivable now. So I think we have to think about the normative structures, not just the technology, or otherwise we're going to be so flexible it's everywhere every time.
Well, I think the knowledge transfer thing that you brought up earlier is key, because we're not, I think we all know that this aging population, but I don't see a lot of companies, including our own, doing that much right now, other than, you know, the mentoring, the kind of advisory partner roles that we've set. But we need to get better at that, because that knowledge will be gone.
We're waiting for panic to set in.
We're waiting for panic, and then the younger generation. The younger generation won't be there long enough because they're going to have five jobs. So then that knowledge gets transferred to people who won't even be there to pass it on. So I mean, I think that's a real challenge for all of us.
And doesn't that suggest that we challenge the notion when we talk about given the mobility, we challenge what we think about retention? For corporations, really, we think about what they need retention. You know, you're not going to retain someone for a vast period.
Yeah, 30 years.
The issue is while you have them there,
yes.
Right. How do you optimize what
exactly.
they can contribute to your
and
organization?
And keep that in the organization and keep
or
it
when
growing.
They, or when they leave, so we're looking at our alumni network as when people leave, is that they're still connected. Even though they're no longer employees, mm-hmm. they're still an extended part of the family. And so even
yeah.
though they're not employees and they're not working for us, we still look for them for information, for ideas, to look at products. And so it extends beyond that whole employment
Absolutely.
Contract.
Absolutely. We're in that
Think about
them
as
yeah.
an ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're
yes.
part of an ecosystem.
But John, the other thing to look at, you know, we talked about decentralization. We talked about the role that technology plays. And one of the things that we've been looking at PricewaterhouseCoopers is how do we also enable our work to move around, right? As we're going to become more decentralized. Now, we don't have a corporate headquarters per se, right? We are in a lot of different cities and a lot of different states. So we already have pods, and you know we can have even more pods. But how can we, you know, enable the work we do to move around right. to again enable the flexibility while we continue to serve right. our clients and do the things we need to do? So that's something we've started to do a little bit and experiment with and see how that goes.
Bring work to the people instead of people to the
exactly.
work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
And I think people too are gonna in terms of mobility. It's also making choices about where you want to live first and then what types of jobs are going to be available that are going to meet your lifestyle needs. So if my desire is to live in the mountains, that's where I want to be able to spend my time. I then want a job that's going to fit my lifestyle, and that's going to be a prerequisite.
But the job 10 years ago that could fit your lifestyle in the mountains, there might have been four jobs. I mean, now I think that there's going to be 400.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
It used to be artisanal cheese. You know, now it could be general counsel. I mean, you know, there's no reason that it can't. We have a good our general counsel. It's interesting. We had an employee who had a very high specialized skill, and they decided their wife was moving to Alaska, and they said, "I got to go to Alaska." And we negotiated with them to actually allow them to telework, so they're still part of our general counsel, but they're going to be working from rural Alaska. So it's amazing. What you couldn't have done that 10 years ago. I mean, the opportunities, I think, are just incredible.
That's a good point.
I think the other thing you're going to see is a lot more public and private partnerships. Mm-hmm. And how can we leverage the resources and what's happening here in terms of the private firms and apply them to nonprofit organizations? Because as we all know, nonprofit organizations are suffering financially.
Right.
And a lot of this has to do with their infrastructure. They can't afford their infrastructure. They don't know how to get at it. And a lot of what we're talking about, I think, is a way to level that so nonprofits then can take the money that they're getting and provide it in terms of their programs and services and not so much their infrastructure. It creates a new relationship.
Right. And I think the last point is, I think actually the conversation here is pretty interesting. Yes, on flexibility, but also on this conversation between the private sector and the public sector. Because when I think about the aging workforce and the challenges of what retirement security is going to mean for me versus my parents, you know, I expect to be working a lot longer. And that's a government issue, certainly, you know, making sure that people have a secure retirement. It's also a private sector issue based on all the different issues we heard today. So I think this is going to be an ongoing, I think what's going to keep happening into the future is this dynamic of what are you hearing in the private sector and how does that resonate back in terms of the government and policy, and then right back at you, yeah.
I think there's another policy implication here, and it's also an employee relations factor, and that is that sort of one of the flip sides of all the things that make us able to be more flexible and to distribute work and to time shift it and to move it around also are the things that enable outsourcing and globalization of the work. So the same thing that allows me to send the work to the mountains of Colorado allows me to send it to Bangalore. And
right.
so our employees, yep. I think, you know, I'm not sure that they completely understand that that's the sort of the double edge of the economy there, and it's got that side of it too.
Absolutely. Yep.
So it means that the task before us is to make sure that our people are competitive in that economy,
right.
And that we have the capability and the skills and the organization to actually enable people in this part of the world to compete effectively with people wherever they are elsewhere in the world as well. And I do think this notion of flexibility really does strengthen that, because you reduce all the anecdotal, incidental, loaded cost about an inflexible system that actually enables us, at least on a cost basis, to be more competitive. And more, and critically, and again, this is why I'm on this thing about enabling very skilled people to get better and better, because they have the opportunity to interact, mentor with, and work on, and become even more, you know, critically skilled in the scheme of things.
But your point about policy is really interesting, because then if you step back and say, okay, what can the government do right now? There's infrastructure around, you know, the internet, because that's how every one of our teleworkers is now connecting. We're dependent on that, that whole infrastructure, even power, you know, how that's distributed. You keep going around education. So you could start to lay out all the policies against this, and there's a whole lot that we need to do to sustain it or to make it better.
To go to two of your points, we funded a number of pilots, and one of them was in a major corporation, and it was in a relatively low-performing unit, and it was being considered as a possible site for offshoring. And the charge given to the unit and the team within that unit was either improved performance by X percent, or you'll be outsourced, and you can choose whatever kind of flexibility you want. And the team worked together. They chose the flexible arrangements that work. They increased their productivity. Morale went up. Self-respect went up. Trust went up. And they're still here in the U.S. So I think, and then there were several others. I mean, Chubb also really, again, it was. We've been talking a lot about flexibility negotiated at the individual level. You mentioned the team before. But we found a lot of the team negotiated flexibility really was an effective means to both maintain, but even more importantly, improve performance. And back to what Doug said, really fell back on the resourcefulness of the employees. They figured out what would work for them.
Yeah.
Any ideas that, you know, you haven't heard said that we want to capture, that you'd like to get out, or that you've been sort of, you didn't get an opportunity to put out? I want to make sure we give everybody a chance. If you have a nugget, we get it from you. So,
And it's around the measurement piece, which I think we've talked about a bit, but I think that it's really going to be important for us to crack the code on how we truly take kind of a baseline of where are we prior to, similar to what you had said, but on a larger scale, and then moving forward into leveraging flexibility and what does that really look like, because that's going to be what captures people's attention.
It's a perfect segue. In my remarks, we're going to be announcing a program that we're launching built on, it's not new to the private sector, it is new to the federal sector today. We're going to be doing a demonstration project on ROWE in the, using OPM as a model for that in the federal government for the first time. But to get to your point exactly, we've hired Deloitte to be the third party investigator, if you will, to come in and set the baseline and then do the third party scoring as we go forward, so the productivity has credibility, if you will, outside the agency when we finish this demonstration project. So I think it's a critical thing going forward, and
you got the right firm doing it.
Well, there you go. So we're really excited by that.
We are very excited.
We'll be coming forward. Well, we have, if we could pass these around to folks, this is the report that Christine was mentioning earlier today. On behalf of the President, on behalf of the First Lady, I want to thank each and every one of you. I know you are incredibly busy in wherever your roles are, whether it be in the private sector or public or nonprofit world or academia. It is so generous of you to give of your time to your country in this way. I can make the pledge to you from both the President and the First Lady, your input today will not go on a shelf. I know from the passion you heard earlier this afternoon from the First Lady, you are going to hear again at 4:30 today from the President himself. They are behind this. They want this to succeed. They really, they have heard, the president has heard the 45% productivity increase. Yeah. He has heard this and he's locked on. And the other thing he's locked on is continuity of operations. Is not just with snow, but you know, we could have a dirty bomb go off in D.C. How do we maintain government operations? And for maintaining this, it's essential that some of these flexibilities are going to allow our government to be more resilient. And so the president is personally driven by this in his role as commander-in-chief of how do I maintain resilience in government? How do I maintain continuity of operations, regardless, whether it be Mother Nature, whether it be a crazy group du jour, and we've got to be able to deal with that. And so, I can promise you that this investment you've made in your government today will not go idle. And we appreciate your generosity and the spirit with which you joined. And thank you on behalf of the President and the First Lady. Now,
thank you.
This is fantastic. Thank you. So I'm going to give you a round of applause.